light at the end of the tunnel. That's according to the World Health Organization that says Africa could soon see the end of the pandemic. But is such optimism justified when few people have access to vaccines and adequate health care? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Many countries are easing restrictions as the number of COVID-19 infections begins to stabilize. Some scientists believe the pandemic is nearly over. The World Health Organization has an optimistic message for nations in Africa that have struggled to secure vaccines and treatment. Its regional director says the continent will soon be able to manage the virus as an endemic disease. Doses of vaccines are starting to arrive in large numbers. Only 10% of Africans are fully inoculated, the lowest in the world. The WHO admits the actual number of infections could be 7 times higher than the official count of 11 million so far. And the pandemic has pushed up to 40 million people into poverty.
It's been an extremely difficult 2 years, but against all odds, Africa is weathering this terrible storm. The continent's long history and experience with large outbreaks, along with an accumulation of learnings and expertise since the onset of COVID-19, has seen the response become more effective with each new wave. A steady supply of doses is now reaching our shores, so the focus needs to be on translating those into actual shots in people's arms.
More jabs are becoming available in Africa as global production ramps up. That should help it tackle the pandemic, but supplies aren't the only hurdle. The continent has received almost 700 million vaccine doses, but people's hesitancy to being inoculated, logistical difficulties, and a lack of resources have hampered immunization efforts for many countries. Uptake varies considerably across Africa. Morocco has more than 60% of its adults vaccinated. In Burundi and Congo, it's less than 1%. Several African countries are making headway in local vaccine production. South Africa is set to be the first to trial a homegrown mRNA jab, but the benefits could be years away. All right, for more on all this, I'm joined by my guests in Johannesburg, Shabir Madhi, Director of the Vaccines and Infectious Diseases Analytics Research Unit of the University of the Witwatersrand. In Abuja is Sarah Maka-Ugbabe, Executive Director of Engagement and Mobilization for One Campaign, an organization fighting extreme poverty and disease. And also in Abuja is Dr. Ifeanyi Nsofor, Community Health Physician and Senior Vice President for Africa at the Human Health Education and Research Foundation. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining the program today. Sarah, let me start with you today. So the WHO's regional head of Africa has said that Africa is transitioning out of the pandemic phase of COVID-19. What does that mean, and what will that transition look like?
Thank you for that question. So while the signs of recovery are encouraging, any recovery is fragile, and in particular for Africa, because you'll recall that over 70% of the high-income countries have gotten vaccinations and therapeutics and testing, and what they need in Africa is hovering right around 11%. So what it means is that Africa is still behind. So recovery truly must be a moment for us to ensure that we actually recover fully from this. In particular, listen to the continent's request for the ability to produce its own vaccines and other medication. And we can't forget the economic crisis that was the tail, and quite frankly, for Africa, the front winds of this crisis. That still remains. So on the health side, things might be improving, but we see that with cautious optimism. But on the economic side, there's still a crisis brewing.
Shabir, you heard Sarah there talk about vaccine production and the importance of it. I'm curious to know your standpoint about how the vaccine trial and the vaccine production is going in South Africa.
So the vaccine rollout in South Africa is about just over 40% of the population that have received at least a single dose of vaccine. In people above the age of 50, who are responsible for more than 80% of the fatal COVID cases, That figure sits at about 60%. But I think what's been experienced in South Africa is not so much a function of vaccines, but rather a consequence of immunity that has arisen over time during the course of the first three waves before Omicron started. And that is immunity that has arisen due to infection with the virus. So in South Africa, 70% of unvaccinated individuals have got immunity against severe disease and death due to past infection. And it's probably not too dissimilar in many other African countries where, despite modest rollout of vaccines and, in fact, sometimes negligible rollout of vaccines, a large percentage of the population have now developed immunity against severe disease and death in particular. And unfortunately, it's a situation where even though vaccines are likely to scale up in terms of access on the African continent, to some extent it's come too late because the loss of life has already transpired. And South Africa is an example as a country. The mortality rate from COVID-19 is in a region of about 490 per 100,000, which is in excess of what has been experienced in the United Kingdom, twice as high and even higher than what is experienced in the United States. But immunity has now arisen against severe disease and death, largely because of high force of past infection.
Ifeanyi, from your vantage point there in Abuja, what do you say? Is it simply too early to make this call with regard to Africa and the pandemic?
I don't think it's too early because if we look at what's happening in the West, you know, countries are beginning to remove restrictions and moving ahead. So we also have to move ahead. But however, I think we have to be very honest with ourselves. With the very low vaccination coverage, what it simply means is that within the next few months, Africa will really be, you know, will be known as the continent, as the COVID-19 continent, because we'll have the lowest vaccine coverage across the world. So in as much as the statement by the WHO Afro head is encouraging, but I think within countries, we have to really ramp up vaccination. And from my position here in Nigeria, for instance, is how do we begin to take vaccines to people where they live and work? Because as it is now, we were waiting for people to come to vaccination centers. But again, if you look at our economy in Africa, about 60 to 70% are within the informal sector. People cannot live where they earn their daily wage to go and look for vaccines. So we have to take vaccines to the people. So we really need to begin to think about innovative ways of ensuring that the increased vaccines we're getting translate to increased vaccination for our people across the continent.
Sarah, I saw you nodding along to a lot of what Ifeanyi was saying there, so I want to give you a chance to respond, to jump in, but I also want to ask you about the problem of vaccine hesitancy on the continent. Why is it as bad as it is right now?
So on Ifeanyi's points, there are positive signals that the pandemic might be tailing over. But you know, the fragility of recovery is where we really have to double down on. Africa has really largely been left unprotected. And we've been here before and we failed to finish the job. And one of the things that heartens me is that we do know how to get vaccines to the last mile. We know how to do it. We did it with polio. It was challenging, but it was done. We do it with the children's vaccines and immunizations and go from house to house. So it's not a question of can we get it to the last mile. It's a question of the way the vaccines came in this time. They came in drips and drabs. And it's really hard to mount a campaign reaching the last mile when we didn't have sufficient supply. And so if you pivot from a supply problem to a demand problem, vaccine hesitancy is not an African problem. It's a global problem. We see it all over the world. But what we've seen is a range of sort of apathy, vaccine apathy, where we're sort of getting on with it because the vaccines weren't coming, you know, things where we needed to move on with life. So folks just forged ahead. A set of misinformation guided by what is in the vaccines. And that's what a vaccine campaign could have done if we had enough supply. But the research is coming out. It's like Africa doesn't have more hesitancy than other parts of the world. In fact, some research says it's 80% receptivity to vaccine, 50% receptivity to vaccine, depending on the country you're looking at. So hesitancy is not the challenge. It really is, let's get the supply on the ground. Let's get them in arms and let's get Africa protected. Unfortunately, this pandemic has revealed the inequities of making sure all of us are protected when a new pandemic or another pandemic is around the corner. So I really hope we can learn from what we've seen and set ourselves up for better protection down the line, because the truth is, until all of us are safe, none of us are safe.
Shabir, Sarah there was talking about some of the challenges when it comes to distributing the vaccine, supply, demand, logistics, at some cases, hesitancy, maybe not as much as has been reported, as Sarah was just describing there. But I want to ask you, from your standpoint, what has to happen in order to turn the corner and in order to make sure that jabs aren't just being produced, but that they're actually going in arms?
Yeah, and I think what's also important, so I fully agree with Sarah in terms of some of the hurdles that we need to overcome. But I think what's equally important is we can't dismiss what has transpired on the African continent. And that is 70 and more percent of the population have now developed immunity against severe disease because of past infection. So whatever vaccine becomes available, it's pretty much a futile exercise right now, trying to go house to house to vaccinate every individual. We need to be much more targeted, and to be able to prevent severe disease and death, we need to focus on people above the age of 50 and people with underlying medical conditions to be vaccinated as a priority, rather than just doing a bean count of number of doses that are being administered. And that would make us much more efficient in a manner in which we can optimize the gain from rollout of vaccines, similar to when we vaccinate children against polio. We vaccinate children against polio because they are most susceptible to infection. And this time around, it's people above the age of 50 that are most susceptible to severe disease, and they probably still stand to benefit from vaccines in protection against severe disease, despite them having been infected in large numbers already from in the past.
Ifeanyi, I saw you nodding along to some of what Shabir was saying there. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I need to add there is that in as much as majority of the population in Africa have gained immunity because of exposure, we also need to bear in mind that as far as the West is concerned, if you're not vaccinated, then that's a problem. Because, you know, going back to what Sarah said about the inequities that this particular pandemic has on Earth, you will find out that it was even so bad some months ago when, you know, the same vaccine that we took on the continent was not recognized in the EU based on the EU Green Pass. So I want a situation whereby we'll strive as much as possible on the continent to make sure that everybody that's eligible is vaccinated. I agree with Shabir that we should prioritize those people, you know, at risk compared to, you know, the younger population. But we should really make sure that everybody gets vaccinated. And we cannot keep waiting for people to come to get vaccinated. For me, I think if you look at the hesitancy, vaccine hesitancy across the continent, it's really more of a structural issue because we don't get vaccines to people. As long as we keep waiting for people to come to health facilities to get vaccinated, it becomes much more difficult. How does a woman that sells wares in the market leave her wares and come to get vaccinated in the health facility? So those strategies that we deployed in kicking out polio, for instance, across the continent, some of the strategies that we need to deploy to make sure that, just like Shabri said, prioritizing those that are at highest risk, but ultimately making sure that everybody, you know, gets vaccinated on the continent.
Sarah, earlier you were talking a bit about the economic impact of COVID-19 across the continent, and I want to go back to that point and have you expand on it a little bit. According to the World Bank, the COVID-19 pandemic is estimated to have pushed up to 40 million people into extreme poverty in Africa. Just how dire is the situation right now?
So jobs and unemployment have really become the pinnacle of what we're seeing with this economic response, especially for the people who face this every day. For the economies, we're seeing economies contract. And what's important is African leaders have been very clear that more needs to be done to help their economies recover. They're not looking for handouts. They want more autonomy and investments, institutions in their healthcare, their economies. At the beginning of the pandemic, African leaders called for $100 billion in SDRs. And as we stand today, we only have about $45 billion in SDRs recycled towards Africa. And to give you what it means in context, SDRs are sort of liquidity being pushed into the economy. In context, America had about $3 trillion in liquidity support for the economies to recover. Europe probably had about over $1 trillion in liquidity support. The entire continent has asked for $100 billion and we're still not there. So you can just imagine what is required to prop up the economy so we can get more jobs, expand, subsidize for lots of lots of businesses that have taken a hit during this COVID. And so that lingering economic tail, the lag effect will remain with us if we don't stand up and do something. It's not just about Africa. It's not sort of us over here. It affects all of us. We know we're in an increasingly interconnected society and economy. So what happens in Africa will affect the rest of the world. So one of the calls we'll be asking for is to ensure that the G7 countries, the richer countries, recycle their SDRs so that Africa gets more support and the people on the continent can feel a relief from what COVID did to the entire world.
Shabir, I know you've addressed a little bit of this in some of your earlier answers, but I do want to talk to you a little bit more about the fact that last week South Africa took a huge step towards what they say is getting back to normal. The government announced the easing of most COVID-19 restrictions and regulations and said it was taking these steps because the proportion of people with immunity to COVID-19 had risen substantially. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. And I don't think a country such as South Africa and most other African countries have got many other options other than to try to get back to a relative normal lifestyle, both to rescue the economy as well as to undo some of the indirect consequences, detrimental consequences of the type of restrictions that have been imposed. So what you see happening in South Africa during the course of the Omicron wave is that if we take all of the number of people that have died of COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, less than 5% of those occurred during the course of the Omicron wave, compared with 50% of all of the deaths having transpired during the course of the Delta variant wave, when there was a substantially lower percentage of the population that had developed immunity. So we've seen this massive decoupling of infections and severe disease and death. And what COVID-19 is all about is not preventing infections, but minimizing severe disease and death. And we've reached that threshold in South Africa where we've seen this decoupling. And in fact, in all likelihood, the number of people that will die of COVID-19 during the course of this year in South Africa wouldn't be too dissimilar to what was experienced with seasonal influenza before the pandemic, and will be substantially lower than the 58,000 people that will die of tuberculosis this year in South Africa. We don't expect more than 10 to 15,000 people, which is a large number, to die of COVID-19 this year. But at the same time, 58,000 people will die of TB this year in South Africa.
Ifani, according to the WHO's figures, Africa is among the least affected continents from COVID. What exactly explains that? Are the deaths and the infection cases undercounted? Is it that the continent has a much younger demographic? What explains that?
Okay, well, I think, first of all, if we go back to what Dr. Tedros said sometime last year, when they reviewed interventions by continent, he acknowledged the fact that Africa as a continent had a better coordinated strategy. So I think that's one. Then secondly, we tend to forget that experience is the best teacher when it comes to, you know, detecting, preventing, and responding to infectious disease outbreaks. As we speak currently, across sub-Saharan Africa, we have at least more than 120 different infectious disease outbreaks happening. You know, so we've built expertise in how to, you know, mobilize communities, do contact tracing, work with different community structures, you know, to be able to make sure that we put out the messaging for infectious disease outbreak, but also to trace people who are infected. You know, but there's no doubt that we're also a youthful population. That, so obviously that has to count as far as the continent is concerned. Look at some of the interventions that the African Union through the Africa CDC initiated during this pandemic. The African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team, the African Medical Supplies Platform, all sorts of, you know, coordinated response across the continent compared to, say, other continents, Europe, you know, America, where countries were more like really doing things on their own. So, and I think that this is something we have to acknowledge, that Africa brings a lot of expertise and leadership when it comes to managing infectious diseases. And I hope that the lessons that we've learned, you know, in responding to this particular outbreak, we're going to apply to dealing with those other outbreaks happening, cholera, yellow fever, and things like that, to make sure that our people do not fall sick, but most importantly, die needlessly from infections that ordinarily we should prevent from happening.
Shabir, it looked like you were reacting to what Ifani was saying. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, unfortunately, I disagree with that analysis. And I don't think we've learned from the swine flu pandemic in 2009, when during the course of the pandemic, less than 5% of all of the cases were documented in Africa and South Asia. And after the pandemic had passed, when they did an analysis of excess mortality, 53% of all of the deaths that occurred due to swine flu occurred in Africa and South Asia. And it's a system of, is a issue of weak systems. The reality right now is that South Africa, which constitutes 5% of the African population, accounts for 45% of all of the cases that have been documented and all of the deaths that transpired. That is not because South Africa is substantially different from other African countries. That is because we do much more testing than any other African country besides Botswana. So your ability to detect cases and even death, when many African countries, even today, don't have vital registration systems in place to actually measure excess mortality, I think it's really, I don't think that we're going down the right path, claiming victory on African continent. Because I think the truth of the matter in terms of burden of disease is yet to materialize with regard to the number of people that have died of COVID-19. South Africa is an example. The recorded number of deaths is about 100,000, just under 100,000 now. But when we look at excess mortality attributable to COVID-19, a country such as South Africa is underestimating death threefold, putting it amongst the top 10 countries with the highest COVID mortality rate globally at about 490 per 100,000. And it's very difficult to understand why other African countries whose healthcare systems are even less resilient than South Africa would be spared the impact of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. It's not because we're good at dealing with other pandemics, because we wouldn't have those other epidemics or the other infectious diseases, because we wouldn't have that problem if we were that great in dealing with it.
Sarah, you know, sometimes a lot of stuff comes down to political will. And I know that, you know, we're talking about lots of different countries here, all with their distinct issues and challenges. But from your perspective, is there political will mostly on the African continent to support the local manufacturing and distribution of vaccines?
So Africa is increasingly speaking with one voice. The question is, the world listening? So this pandemic really reflected how Africa organized and had a uniform and a collective political will to do what it needed to do. And when you juxtapose that with the political will that we needed from North America and Europe to end the pandemic, it's missing. So one of the things that Africa is calling for is self-sufficiency in vaccine production, and not just vaccines, to the point that both gentlemen made earlier. We need vaccines, therapeutics, diagnostics, testing. It needs to be a suite of products. And so there's a lot of political will right now. There'll be an event in Germany where biotech and African leaders are standing to make sure that we can develop and create vaccines on the and manufacture vaccines on the continent. There's been a lot of energy from Rwanda, South Africa, Senegal to make sure those are hubs for vaccine therapeutics, diagnostic development. But another pandemic cannot see Africa holding the end of the bag again. And as such, I want to believe that the African leaders have woken up to the reality that self-sufficiency and protecting her people from another pandemic or one like this is essential, because what happened with this pandemic is just a spotlight on the inequality that it revealed. And so that has really driven a lot more political will. I will have to add that we saw a failure of political will from the West, quite frankly. It was a doubling down on nationalistic tendencies, and the science and the common sense approach to this pandemic required looking at your people, but looking at others as well, because again, there needed to be a collective protection for us to get out of this pandemic. So if we take the lessons that we've learned today and with this pandemic so that we're better prepared the next time something like this shows up, I hope the world can stand up and have a passing mark, because we didn't this time.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much to all of our guests, Shabir Madhi, Sarah Mekka-Ugbebe, and Ifanye Nsofor. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.